chest. Okay. I've been going to Woody Allen movies for decades. When I was a kid, we didn't have Pixar, we didn't have Disney, we had like Mel Brooks movies, we had Monty Python movies, we had Woody Allen movies. These were the movies we went to until about the mid 80s when E.T. and Close Encounters. Then all of a sudden, I mean, I was already a little older, but I'm just saying that growing up, yes, we had occasional kiddie movies, but most of the time we had to go see movies that appealed to a very broad audience. And those were generally comedies. And Woody Allen movies were there. I remember seeing them in my teens. When we were kids, everybody quoted lines from Bananas and Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex and Sleeper. Those were the movies in our, like, you know, in our world. Well, of course, then as I grew older, Woody Allen grew older with me. I became a young adult just as Woody Allen moved into more sophisticated movie making. So he made Annie Hall. And even before that, he made Played Against Sam, which he didn't direct, right? I don't think he directed that one, but he wrote it and he acted in it. And then he made Annie Hall and he made Manhattan. And he made Stardust Memories, and then he went into films like Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy and Another Woman and Radio Days and on into this really amazing period, Zelig, and on through into the 80s, hit or miss, but even the misses were very few other filmmakers who had such an identity and who created such a difference in that people anticipated these movies. And it was right around that time also in the early to mid-80s where he started making a movie every year. And if you can believe it or not, right through this year, 2015, I think he's made now a movie for about 35 years in a row, if you can believe that. Well, I can kind of believe it because I'm telling you, for about the last half of those years, if not more, the movies have been horrible. I'm just going to say it. There has been a couple of amazing performances in, well, more than a couple, but a handful. You know, certainly Blues Jasmine is a good example of that. There might have been some good examples in a few other films, but they've been mostly crap. I think the end of his period came just as things went south for him in terms of his reputation. I'm not even going to get into the specifics of all that because that's just a rabbit hole. It's a quagmire. I'm not doing it. But just around the time of Sun Yi, he made a couple of films around that time. One was Husbands and Wives. And there were just that period of time, right? We're deconstructing Harry. And it was this period where it was like the last bits of spark, you know, were sort of like following the vehicle. The Woody Allen vehicle. And that was it. Then it burnt out. I don't care. I don't care what you think. I don't care what festival you program. I don't care what you say. That's it. I haven't seen anything worthwhile. I just haven't. And in the last few years, it's just been the worst. All right. Now, there may be, again, there are people that will stand behind, you know, the thing in Paris and the thing in Rome. I don't know. To me, it's just all crap. And so I went to last year to see this movie, Magic in the Moonlight, and I just couldn't believe just how bad a movie this was. If anybody else's name was attached to it, it would have never, I don't even think, been distributed. And then this new one I saw last week or the week before, which is called Irrational Man. I didn't think it could get worse, but it's just the worst pile of I've sat through in ages. And, you know, I sat through it only for one reason, because I was trying to get Parker Posey, who by the way, is that one beam of light. She's the Kate Blanchett of this movie. And by the way, the movie doesn't even give her that meaty a role. At least Kate Blanchett had a meaty role, and she ran with it. So making, you know, Blue Jasmine was worth seeing on some level. But this movie, not at all. Not remotely. Parker Posey pumps whatever oxygen and life into this film that she can. And it's an admirable job. And I wanted her on the podcast, so I watched the movie. And then I was told that she's not available. So, you know, I'm just telling you right now, that's my feelings about it. That's my Woody Allen spiel. I wish Woody Allen were relevant. I wish he were making great films. I wish he didn't have all these personal issues and that he didn't turn into some weird, just creepy person. But yet they just sort of, they line up. They line up to be in his films. I don't see it. So it's a weird thing. So that's my last Woody Allen movie ever. I'm no longer going to do it. I've seen them, I think everything, just because, you know, there's always the hope. Because for some period of time in my early years, he meant something to me. Something very significant. All right. Episode number 305 of FilmLax Radio. It's a great episode, folks. We have Kimberly Levine and Neil Huff. Kimberly is the director of a film called Runoff. It's already had its New York run. I'm sorry about that if you're in New York. But if you're in L.A. or in Louisville, Kentucky, you have an opportunity. It's coming out this Friday. And then it will continue to come out around the country. So I'll put the links of where you can see it. I think we talk about it a little bit in this segment. Kimberly is the director. Neil, he's a wonderful guy. He is the actor, the lead actor in this film, which is a sort of environmental, I guess you could say, horror film. But it's not really a horror film, essentially. But it has elements of that in it. But it's definitely about an ethical dilemma that a woman faces while her family and her livelihood and her home are all in the balance, you know, and she's fighting for her life. And this movie really puts you in this suspenseful, stressful spot, and it's called Runoff. And it will soon be available, of course, on demand. Also on this episode, we have Keith Miller, who is returning for his third visit. Keith was on several years ago with his first feature. I think it was his first feature. It's called Welcome to Pine Hill. He's now back with a feature film called Five Star. And his two lead actors, Primo and John Diaz, are on the segment as well. So, and that film is about, Primo plays a variation of himself, a gang leader who takes as his protege this young kid played by John Diaz, and through this relationship he finds out a lot of history about his own father and his father's relationship with Primo, and it's quite a stirring ethnic it's quite a stirring urban drama about loyalty, family, life in the street, yeah, all these things, but it's about, and friendships and coming of age. Five Star will be at the IFC Center this Friday. So I'll be back in a little bit just to introduce that. And we'll start with Kimberly and Neil. Then we're going to go into segment two with documentary filmmaker Bridget Mayer, who is has made a documentary produced by Ricky Lake, by the way. And this one's called The Mama Sherpas. And it's about giving birth vaginally. There I said it. Bridget herself was a cesarean on her first birth, and then insisted, after educating herself, she insisted on having a vaginal birth, even though the medical culture, the institutional medical culture, make it difficult for many women to have to take the risks that they call risks, instead of giving the full maybe information. But more importantly, families have to ask for that information and pursue that information. And that's what this documentary is about. And it shows a number of different examples of women giving vaginal births. Seems like a simple thing, but after cesareans, it isn't. And they all work with midwives. So this is about midwifery. It's about vaginal births after cesarean births. And it gives a whole range of different people having different experiences, and it's a fascinating documentary, and it's currently available on demand. As you hear this conversation, as you hear this episode, you can go afterward and watch the movie on most major on-demand platforms. So let's go right now into my conversation with Kimberly and Neil, fine actor, and then we'll be back to introduce the other two segments. Episode 305, FilmWax Radio. My name's Adam Shartoff. Let's go into the show. Thanks so much for putting up with my rant.
now you're scared.
So to set up the scene, we're in the heart of Williamsburg, and Kurt Pitzer just is backing out of the room. But come back in a little while and visit and check in with us, producer Kurt Pitzer, where we have the director, Kimberly Levin.
Levine.
Is it Levine you go by?
It is.
Yeah.
Really?
It is.
But you don't have an E at the end?
I know. It's tricky.
This changes everything. I don't know if I can do this now.
Maybe you should go.
Your name is Levin.
I know.
Well, since actually, when is that Levin?
It's really Baranovsky.
What?
It's really Baranovsky.
Baranovsky?
That's our real last name, but we didn't find that out till it was too late.
Okay.
Well, I guess it's never too late, but.
But yeah, you're Levin. Okay.
Levin.
So we're joined by, I don't even know if I can say this with a straight face now, Kimberly Levin. I guess a lot of countries, like in Spain, they would say Levin, right?
It's
they
true.
Would.
Yeah.
And last but certainly not least, actor Neil Huff.
That's right.
And my new friend.
Yeah.
My new companion.
It's Louis. Actually Hoof.
To be honest, you want to go to the name
right.
thing? It was at some point I found out Von Hoff. Yeah, right. That's not Levin, is it?
What is the root of your name?
That
then?
Would be Austrian.
It is Austrian.
Yeah,
Von
I'm
Hoff.
Predominantly Irish by background, but yeah, there's Austrian in there. Yeah.
What are you referring to? All is a series
there was
of lies.
A moment in a thing I did a couple of years ago, where I was playing kind of a proto. It looked, proto-Nazi. I had a small role in Grand Budapest Hotel.
You did.
And when I put the costume on, I was like. Oh, whoa, there was something about that
yeah,
I was like, oh, wow, that looks like one of the real guys.
Yeah. When you saw yourself with this, with the costume on.
Something.
The uniform.
Yeah, happened.
There's something that was genetic, maybe.
Yeah.
On some level.
Yeah.
That is something. Did you ever have that experience on another set or in a different costume? Similar thing when you saw yourself?
At my wedding, my wife's family's from southern India, and she was in a sari, and I was like, whoa, just something kind of clicks, And I was like, wow, and then I had that moment dressed like a Von Hoff.
Wow. So, yeah, right?
Although you found out that there was a kind of genetic familial link to what you were doing in our film in Runoff and your heritage.
True too.
Which is really fascinating.
I once wore a giant pickle costume, and I felt that way. So I don't know what that means. But I've known you now for a couple of weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, Neil, for instance. And, I say this because I wouldn't, like, if I knew Neil from the start was going to be somebody who I would have, and I didn't know was going to have on the show, I would have looked up everything and known all the stuff, but it's been this unusual journey to this point, even though it's been short, and I just never even took a look. Like, so every time he mentions something, oh, I did this thing kind of, and it's like one thing after another. So finally, for the first time, I'm looking at your list of films here because which is just astounding. It's really impressive here. I knew about Meek's Cutoff. Well, you told me about it. That's how come I knew about it. Because I have to go back and rewatch. Jack and Diane? Oh, I saw Jack and Diane.
That's a film by Bradley Russ Gray.
I think you're wrong. No, can I? I know that his films are very good, Bradley Russ Gray.
Yeah, and his wife, So-Young Kim, make extraordinary films.
Oh, yes, I remember this. I did see this. This was the two girls?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I saw Tribeca, yeah.
You might not recognize me because I had a stocking over my face, and I was pleasuring myself. And to a sleeping girl, yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So they were just typecasting.
Yeah,
that
that's
one.
Generally. Yep.
That's what happens.
I mean, it's kind of a go-to move. No one else wants to do it, so.
Get Neil. Bonhoff, he'll do.
You know what he's good at.
How did you guys meet? Because, Kimberly, you cast him as your lead actor in Runoff.
Well, we found ourselves in a similar situation, I think, to most low-budget independent films, where we were, you know, there was a kind of star who was a star name, who was interested in doing the film.
Okay.
And, you know,
who was first attached.
Who was
first, or potentially attached.
Potentially attached.
Yeah.
And we found ourselves in a situation, you know, playing chicken with the calendar, because the film is shot seasonally. So we had one go a year to do it. And at a certain point, I said, you know what? Let's just pull the trigger. I had worked before. I was in film. I was in the theater. I love working with actors. And I said, you know what? Let's get a great casting director and let's cast out of the room in New York. Whoever wins the part in the room, that's who we're going to make the film with.
Nice.
And that's what happened with Neil. I mean, you know, when he walked in the room, as soon as he walked out, it was, you know, Kurt and I were kind of high-fiving that we found Frank. It was just, it was instantaneous. And so, yeah, I mean, we met in a casting room in New York after his audition.
You mentioned before we started that you heard the Jeff Lipsky segment, right? Thank you for listening to that, by the way. And then there's been a couple of instances where I've heard similar stories where they're first going for a name, but because there's always a bigger scheduling issue, the bigger the name. And I hate using that term. Neil, it's kind of tacky, but pardon me.
Von Hoff is a good name.
It is.
No, I agree. And go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jeff Lipsky, he just said that they were trying to get for this role, this particular role of the father or the, you know, Treat Williams. Remember this? And he said that it was like, wait, constantly taking forever to figure it out. And on top of it, Jeff said that Treat Williams had become a Mormon or something. Okay.
Wow.
Maybe got cast in the Book of Mormon. Maybe that's what he meant. But anyway, he went with this actor, much lesser known actor named Reed Birney, who subsequently now is become a very big actor because he got the role of the vice president on House of Cards. But he said, I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
Let me go with the really talented workaday theater actor. And he does what he did. So good for you.
Well, I also think it's a fantasy. And I think it's a fantasy for a lot of first-time filmmakers that gets foisted upon them sometimes by, you know, executive producers who may have more experience in the business, you know, to the extent that it you know, it's going to solve all your problems. This is going to fix all the money problems. It's going to make raising money easier. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of filmmakers end up sometimes doing something that damages the film in the end because, you know, to solve a money problem or to make the money come in more easily, they go with a name that maybe is not the right fit for the film. And so that was part of it too. In my gut, you know, I felt like this was a world because, you know, we shot on all working farms in the middle of rural farmlands in the United States. And, you know, you needed a name, a recognizable actor, I think, in a way would have pulled you out of this circumstance into these places. And I knew I needed to find actors who were at once incredible, but also you believed were organically a part of this world.
Yeah, right. There are certain actors you can't quite imagine working on a farm quite as much, although, you know, we see it all the time.
And,
you know,
part of it, I think, you know, both of the actors, both Neil and Joanne, who plays the female lead in the film, both have a lot of theater experience, and there's a kind of physicality to both of their performances, you know, a real groundedness and a real presence in their body, not just in the intonation of the way they deliver lines or in their facial expressions, but really a kind of connectedness to and a rootedness to the ground, to the earth, that both of them carried in their body that was, you know, were huge additions to the film and made their performances a lot more organic. And I think part of that goes back to their, you know, some theater work and theater training, just being in their bodies in such a kind of present way.
It's a real stressful situation, these two. There is a family who are living on a farm. They are hanging on by their fingernails economically, financially, while a number of farms around them are selling to corporations, Monsanto type, right? And so the banks are turning them down for loans.
Or they're basically, you know, finding themselves where they're at a point, their backs are against the wall because they're at a point inside of their industry. They actually are people who sell supplies to farmers. And so they're selling everything from feed and seed to pharmaceuticals and injectable hormones to the farmers, and find themselves where they are kind of just coming to terms with the fact that their small businesses have already been eaten up by these larger entities. And so that there really isn't a path forward. And part of what the drama of the film is this family kind of coming to terms with the space they find themselves in. And there's kind of a Western element to it, really, in the sense that, you know, it's a family who is, you know, a husband and a wife who go to desperate lengths to defend their family when they're threatened off their land. So there's a kind of Western feel to it also, mm-hmm. in terms of defending a way of life and a piece of land and a place in America.
Mm-hmm. And so at a certain point, a quick solution is presented to Neil's, your wife, the wife's role. And it creates a very enormous ethical dilemma with either it's a lose-lose.
That's right. And part of it is about, you know, when we talk about the story and talk about some of the themes of the story about, you know, when we find ourselves in a situation where we're facing, you know, incredibly pressing, urgent needs of the present moment and how those things kind of come up against our concept of legacy and what our responsibility to our own legacy is. And there's a kind of time compression that happens in the film, which is kind of in the denouement of the film, where legacy and the needs of the present moment kind of come crashing against each other, and the family has to deal with how all this falls out.
Neil, you grew up in this here in New York.
And, I grew up in New York, yeah.
Right. And growing up, did you, I don't know, go to summer camps or did you go to school like in a rural area? I mean, what if any?
Well,
history do you have in a rural setting where other than making films?
Yeah, no, my mother is from Louisville, from the area.
That's
so
right. Mm-hmm.
I was really happy when we spoke at the audition that Kim and Kurt knew the bar where my uncle worked for years in Louisville, Dutch's Tavern. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah. And so on that side, you know, my family, you know, I'm saying, you know, my family goes way back in the Midwest. So on that side of my family, there was a connection. But then on the other side, on my dad's side, I learned this when I got the gig.
Yeah.
I did not know this, but my great-grandfather basically, with a chemist, came up with a hog serum. That was his whole line of work, hog serum. He was a vet and came up with this hog serum that is kind of considered largely responsible for eradicating the hog cholera of the 20s and 30s.
That's not swine flu. That's something else?
Yeah, I think it was before that, yeah.
Okay.
And what was just wiping out hogs. And so he was very, very responsible and successful in the Midwest and then didn't want to diversify. There was kind of a faction that split off, a family that went to Colorado, and they still exist, the Colorado Serum Company. But that was basically that first opening scene of the film where you see Frank, my character, injecting hogs. That was literally what my great-grandfather was doing for a long, long time, you know, extracting blood and coming up with the right thing. And then strangely enough, also like the character Frank, he didn't listen to the kind of family concerns about the need to diversify. And so he just kind of stayed small and kept things doing, the business going the way he saw the business going properly. And it just kind of eventually, The family lore is that, like, if he just diversified, there'd be, like, all this crazy success and money. But, you know, yeah.
Right.
Sioux City, Iowa was where that whole family comes from. Yeah, big, big meat town. And
And so you're familiar with this bar that his uncle? Is that what it was?
I am. Mm-hmm. Your uncle.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, I grew up in Louisville, so we ended up shooting most of the film, all of it on location in Kentucky, but a lot of it just right outside of Louisville where I grew up. So there were a lot of old haunts that Neil would visit every summer that I was very, very familiar with. We started realizing that in the audition, actually, that we had a lot of kind of common ground.
And strangely, that your mentor theatrically was the guy that directed me in, you know, played Romeo at the Actors Theater of Louisville back in the mid-90s. and directed by John Jory, which is Kim's kind of, you know, segue out of biochemistry into the entertainment business, was being his kind of, well, what were you exactly?
His assistant.
Yeah, his mentee.
Yeah. I had a kind of old-fashioned mentorship with, yeah, apprenticeship with John. I was a one-on-one mentorship, which was really the kind of transformational moment for me coming out of biochemistry and going into theater and then ultimately film. So yeah, we had that in common too. And it was also great in terms of, you know, on a low budget film like this, having a dialect coach is, you know, an impossibility. And I knew with Neil, that one thing that we were not going to have to deal with, that he knew how to kind of drop into the accent. And, you know, we were going for something that felt regional, but nothing kind of over the top, because you also have to make sure there's a kind of legibility and that people can understand the characters. So we were going for a kind of lazy male where you're not hitting your consonants so much.
Is that the dialect?
It's not the official dialect, but you know, where you don't hit your consonants and you kind of just get a little lazy in your mouth. And that came very naturally to Neil, having spent his summers in Louisville. He knew that kind of, that rhythm to his speech. So I was like,
If you drink enough Big Red, do you know that soda, Big Red?
No.
You should try it. Give some to your son. The sugar crash is so extreme.
It's so extreme that you can't even manage to move your jaw when you talk.
Exactly.
Because you're just slack jawed.
And then you
exhausted.
That's how the accent happens.
Yeah. There's a new thing that they're doing, apparently, that I've been hearing about it, where it's called like something juice or some sort of concoction where they take Coke and 7-Up, like different sodas and juices, and they put them all into, you know, big pitcher or whatever, big cup, and they drink them, and it's supposed to have like that kind of like crazy sugar rush, like uber sugar rush.
And then
of course, well, yeah, there must be.
What's it called?
I forget the nickname for this thing. I'm sure you could figure it out pretty easily. That went off on a tangent.
Twinkie defense.
What?
The Twinkie defense.
What's that?
Oh, there's a guy that shot up a McDonald's.
And I
think they went with the Twinkie defense, big old sugar high and crash.
Oh yeah. Well, there always is a reason. You know, you could say it's a Twinkie. You could also just say I was beat up as a kid. I mean, there's obviously nobody in their right mind is going to do it. So there's always a defense, but that is just ridiculous. Why don't you go with the actual reason, which is you're nuts?
Or just try and eat a box of Twinkies and see what happens.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Right. The prosecution is like, we just ate Twinkies an hour ago before we came in here. What if things come true that we have something called the Twinkie defense? I don't know.
It's kind of like runoff. You know?
Yeah.
What we put in our bodies, where it comes from.
Yeah, right. Well, there is a number of characters that are dealing with some sort of unidentified malady. But you see things that lead you to make connections, like a crop duster constantly, this sort of looming and sort of ominous thing that keeps passing over it with its
pesticide.
Right, well, yeah. You know, it's weird. I went to upstate last weekend. Warwick, New York. And with a friend of mine, we just, the 5th of July, we went up there for the day, and it was really hot and humid. And we went cherry picking and fruit, you know, to a U-pick farm. And we were, you know, up in the trees and a lot, like climbing up into the trees and grabbing cherries. And you try every so often, try the cherries, see how they taste, because you want to see if you got a good batch and if it's sweet and plump. And so I ate probably 20 cherries. I don't know. That would not get you in of itself. Is not, but I by the next morning, that night and in the morning, I was sluggish, probably dehydrated, but also I feel like I felt weird, like I felt not normal, and it could have been mostly dehydration, but I think it was also pesticides that I didn't think about. Oh, these cherries, probably, you know, and also climbing in the trees. She had a rash. It didn't itch her or hurt, but she had like a bump, little, you know, bunch of bumps on her arm, both of her arms, climbing, reaching through the branches and all that. So it's disturbing, you know. I mean, I guess there's a reason why they tell you to wash off the fruit really thoroughly. I thought I'd just share that because, you know, it's a very tiny version of your runoff.
A little Roundup hangover.
Yeah, another reference. What?
Roundup I actually don't know. I should not say that. That Roundup is necessarily what they would use on a cherry tree, but that's kind of the centerpiece spray chemical solution that Monsanto, I believe, owns. And so it's a weed killer, essentially. Oh. But, you know, it's considered safe. And right. There was a famous moment in Washington, right? Who was it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And someone said, okay, if it's safe, you to the lobbyist, here, drink it, drink it. And the guy wouldn't.
Right.
I forget who it was.
Yeah.
So it's called Roundup?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just for weed killing.
Weed killing. You can buy it in any kind of hardware store, or any kind of big box store.
Right.
All these things. Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the intended thing, is to draw the audience into thinking about what are the things in the barrels in the film or on the shelves in the stores that, you know, that we're putting on our food and putting into our water, and drawing the audience into, inviting them into a conversation about the safety of the things that are in our food and water, and inviting them to think about the connections between things.
It also reminds me of that Kelly Reichardt moment in Night Moves, where the girl's father, remember, is like, she's has a really bad relationship with him because he comes from, it's been a while since I've seen it, but remember the whole swamp nearby, or the creek, or maybe it's not a creek, but it's also polluted, and you know, chemicals are in there that he's helped me responsible for. And I think they have a gun or something. Did you see it? Night Moves? And don't they force him to get into the water, and he refuses, and then, do you remember what I'm talking about? It's a very disturbing scene. Oh, you know, this idea of environmental, while we're on the subject of Night Moves and also Runoff, they share this thing which we're seeing more and more, which are these environmental films. And so I don't know if you, like, set out. You probably didn't. It was just, you kind of described how you got to the story, but it's something that has a connection.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Kentucky, and where I grew up, there were a lot of farms around me, but I don't come from that kind of background. And actually, the seeds of the story are quite different than, I mean, they're rooted in what the story is on screen, but came to me when I was working as a biochemist.
Chemist.
And I was actually testing stream waters, so doing field biochemistry research in Kentucky, and helped to uncover that there was a textile plant that was dumping raw, untreated effluent into a tiny little tributary that flowed into Lake Cumberland, which is the largest state attraction, this beautiful lake.
Uh-huh.
It's a place where a lot of people get their drinking water from and fish out of. And the information was picked up on by activists and attorneys. Ultimately, the plant was closed down, which seems like it should be a victory, but the plant was relocated to a different community. So, you know, I started obsessing about and thinking about the way that people make decisions and the way that people prioritize and who they prioritize when they make a decision. And I started to kind of meditate on, if my back were against the wall, I lived in a, you know, geographically isolated area and didn't have many options. If I had to make a tough decision, who's inside the circle with me? Is it me? Just me? Is it my family? Is it my community? And how far out does that circle extend in terms of who I prioritize when I make a choice? So that's not what the story of Runoff is about. It's set in the world of kind of the underbelly of the agricultural world. So I took those themes and the kind of story that I had seen unfold personally, and wanted to place it into a world that touches all of us. I mean, nobody can escape food and having to eat. And the fact that food and how we make food, you know, process food and how we grow food affects our water. So that was my desire, to kind of put it into that arena. So when I set out to deal with kind of the ecological aspects of the film, they were very intentional, and they're things that kind of haunt me and take up a lot of my brain space. And I wanted to find a way to do it in a narrative fashion that, again, like I said a few minutes ago, invited the viewer into having a dialogue with themselves and with each other about the choices that we make, how we prioritize things, what is in our food, what is in our water, who's looking out for us. And maybe at the end of the day that we're the only ones looking out for us.
Did they test the water in the Cumberland?
Yeah. I mean, that was how the plant
the tributary
shut down.
Okay.
Yeah. Ultimately.
They tested the water in this space where people got the drinking water and were recreating, and right, not just obviously the tributaries was absolutely polluted, but
yeah.
I was wondering if the Cumberland obviously had to be somewhat. It had to be in there.
I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, when you get down to the kind of technicalities of it, you have the EPA on a state level, and a lot of the times, you know, that was that textile plant was employing thousands of people in a very remote region and had a lot of pull kind of politically in the state. So when you get to kind of state political level, you know, it's very easy to turn a blind eye to as a, you know, somebody who works for the EPA, or you go out and test on a day when they're closed and the water quality is different. So there are a lot of ways to get around things. So, you know, to me, it was about dramatizing a situation where nobody is the good guy or the bad guy, but everybody's backs against a wall and all of our hands are dirty in the sense that all of us are living inside of this system. None of us are outside of it and none of us are above it. And so I wanted to find a way to pull people into a drama, into a narrative that allowed them to kind of put themselves into a character, you know, take a ride with a character who ultimately maybe they wouldn't make that choice or feel like they wouldn't want to make that choice. But, you know, on some level, you know, we're making the bargains that this family does every day in every choice that we make.
So think about that, America, every time you throw something out or go to the supermarket and buy a certain product.
Well, things are complicated. I mean, every choice we make, I mean, you know, where we get our energy from, if I'm going to not have a drink of water right now or drink out of a plastic bottle, you know.
Yeah, that's one that I've really been pushing myself to just never, you know, getting bottles of water for one thing. There's just no reason to. There's just no good reason anymore.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm with
we
you
know
on
too
that.
Much. Runoff is currently in theaters. It's going to be in L.A. and in Louisville beginning July the 24th.
July 24th.
So I know this will be up by then.
We were extended in New York for a second week, which
that's
is
amazing.
Really amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
I think they have a few theaters in that place, right?
Yeah, they have a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got held over in New York and have now been booked into 15 cities so far.
Did that come up because you now said, oh, we have a second week in New York?
It was, you know, when we were entering the New York theatrical run with a film this small, everything is kind of dependent on both the critical response to the film and a kind of combination between that and the box office success in New York. So thank goodness both of those things kind of came through and, you know, people who had been interested in the film and booking the film outside of New York were kind of waiting to see how it was going to perform in New York. And as soon as it did, you know, we just got all those bookings and they're rolling. In fact, the digital release date has gotten pushed back, I think, 3 or 4 weeks. So we're going to have a whole month extension on what would have been a 5-week dedicated theatrical window is now going to be about 9 weeks. Actually, it might be more than that. I don't even know. Which is going to give more opportunity for other theaters around the country to kind of pick up the film. So it's been a really exciting time and you know, an amazing response to the film, which we're really grateful for.
Yeah, right. You had a couple of really stellar reviews, too. The Roger Ebert one, is that the one you were talking about, that, Neil?
Matt Zoller Sites, for RogerEbert.com.
Yeah, he's going to be in the neighborhood just a couple of blocks away on the 20th doing something of videology with Rahman Barani, which did a movie, I think, I'm not going to go and diss Rahman Barani before I'm going to ask him to come on the show because he's got a new movie coming out.
99 Homes?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really excited to see it.
Me too. Press screening invitation there.
Right on.
Neil and I went to see this, I mentioned in my last show, the Marlon Brando.
The Brando, I know.
So very good.
Have you read his autobiography?
Right. Oh, no.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Oh, I got to read that,
just
too.
Just incredibly funny and brilliant.
Yeah.
Everything from trying to convince his anesthesiologist when he was being circumcised at the age of 62, I think it was, to not give him any anesthetic because he was going to meditate down into, you know, such a deep place.
Oh, right, his meditation.
The meditation.
Which comes up in this movie.
Yeah. His arrival into his island, his atoll, for the first time and being pitched out of a boat over the coral. It's one of the funniest things you've ever read. It's just a brilliant piece.
I just remember, speaking of meditation, Listen to Me, Marlon, is him saying that, I think. It's right? That's from his meditation, I think, the title. Maybe? No?
Probably. Yeah, I think he was.
I'm just figuring that out, by the way.
And it was self-hypnosis.
Yeah. Eat less, Marlon. It's just because he got so fat.
Heartbreak.
It was kind of hard.
Because he said, and you will lose
the fat.
You know,
lose
fat. Visualization.
Yeah, visualize. Heartbreak. Yeah.
He did say famously, you know, first it was the women, then it was the ice cream.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Grab the women, leave the ice cream. Another reference. Wasn't his line, but you see movie, right? Los Angeles, if you're listening, you can go see this movie on the 24th of July because you'll be hearing this before the 24th. So
come out and see us. We were able to put together a bunch of really cool post-screening conversations here in New York.
Oh, good.
We did one with Joyce Carol Oates, one with Dan.
I so wanted to make that because
it was amazing.
I wanted to meet her so much.
Oh, my God. She's incredible.
How'd you
she's
work that
so
out?
So incredible. It was a connection of Kurt's. Kurt, in addition to being...
to knowing Paul White's.
You know, yeah.
I got it. That. I just saw something. What did I watch? Again, it's
Grandma?
Just
did you see
yes.
Grandma? Yes.
Yeah. I went to see it.
No, I can't
it.
Wait to see it.
I saw it right before I saw the Marlon Brando the same day.
Oh, and what an amazing day.
It was
day.
A great... It was. That doesn't happen. So
we're in the midst of trying to put together some similar
yes.
kind of post-screening conversations in Los Angeles, and hopefully we'll have announcements about those soon. But we did some really cool things. The one with Joyce was amazing.
I wish I could have been there.
We also had another incredible conversation with Marion Nessel, who's kind of the Noam Chomsky of food, and Marcus Samuelson, who is both a celebrity chef and a kind of, I don't know, he's just a thinker in that field. So the conversations have been really interesting. They've spanned everything from...
Well, that's what I'm thinking, because the movie really does lend itself to so many different... There's so many different, you know, subjects that you can touch on. The movie touches on a lot of subjects, so that gives it... You could do a lot of different creative things. It's true. Yeah. Yeah, and you're going out there, so it'd be all new... Many new people you can tap into out there.
Yeah.
That's nice.
We're excited about it.
I'm so. First of all, the response to Runoff as a film critically has just been so lovely, and just responding to it on purely cinematic level. In addition to that, I'm so excited about the film coming to the Midwest, where it's set,
right?
And you know,
yes, it'll also be in Louisville, starting
Chicago
July 24th.
And stuff. I'm really excited to see the response.
The Siskel Center or something.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, it's going to be at the Gene Siskel Theater. That's going to be in August, and we've got a booking in both North and South Carolina, and we're waiting to hear from some places deeper in the Midwest, kind of Iowa.
Great.
Which would be, it'll be really cool to take the film there. And
well, so glad we just happened to be reaching for the same scone on that morning in Nashville.
I know.
Because otherwise none of this may have happened. Who knows?
It's true.
And my friend Mark Rabinowitz, who was there, that also came down and met, he lives in Louisville.
In Louisville,
right now, so you have to get him to maybe do a Q&A with you guys.
That's a great idea.
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much, Adam.
This is my conversation with Bridget Mayer regarding her film, again, The Mama Sherpas. Please do check it out. It's being distributed by Bond 360, a terrific company doing terrific work, one of a number of fine art house film distributors, and I'm always happy to get behind those films with such terrific filmmakers. So here again, my conversation with Bridget Mayer. Well, we're talking to Bridget Mayer, who is the director of The Mama Sherpas, which is a brand new documentary. Which, when is it premiering?
So it premiered last month in Los Angeles, and it's screening across the country right now. And then it's going to premiere on digital platforms, iTunes and Amazon, etc., starting July 21st. And we're very excited about this because it's a real opportunity to reach a very large audience with the documentary.
You find that, late term pregnant women aren't running to the movie theaters as often?
I think that one of the developments that have been happening in the past 5 years is that women are empowering themselves as they prepare for their birth, and many women can actually be running to the movie theater in the last few weeks of their pregnancy if they've been running the whole time. So I wouldn't totally discount that, but certainly it's a lot easier to be able to purchase or rent the film on iTunes. Definitely more accessible.
All right. Well, yes, that's true. And that will be, again, available starting July. Did you say 21st?
July 21st,
Very good. When we finish talking, they can jump right over to iTunes or Amazon or whatever their preferred method of streaming is and watch the film.
Great.
So, well, it's delightful to talk to you. I have one of my oldest friends in the world is a midwife up in Cambridge. She's been doing that as far back as I can probably. I guess she's a certified nurse midwife because she's in Massachusetts, correct?
Well, you know, certified nurse midwives are the midwives that I feature in the documentary because the documentary focuses on hospital midwives.
Yes, and that's her. She's in a practice there. She's working in a facility. I know that for sure.
That's great. And, you know, we featured four different practices in the documentary, one of which was Bay State Medical Center, which is a large education medical facility in Springfield, Massachusetts, where they have a midwifery practice integrated into the obstetrics department, and we feature them in the film. Massachusetts has a great system, and they have a great public health care. They have a great insurance program.
So you had a baby. How old is your daughter now?
My daughter is 3 and a half.
Oh, that's wonderful. Congratulations.
I have two children. I have a 7 and 3-year-old.
Oh, the boy. You have a boy that's 7.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And he was the cesarean.
He was. He was my little cesarean baby, yes.
And so your daughter was a vaginal birth, right? The post-cesarean vaginal.
Yes. She was my VBAC baby. She was my vaginal birth after cesarean.
Okay. This term, how did that come about?
So vaginal birth after cesarean, or VBAC, is a medical term to describe when women have vaginal births after cesareans. And, you know, one of the things that has happened in about the last decade, 10 to 15 years, is that many hospitals across the country, due to insurance and risk issues, which is a long and complicated discussion that probably could fill multiple podcasts, decided to impose VBAC bans, meaning that they would not allow women to have vaginal births after cesareans at their hospitals, which meant that women had no choice but to have repeat C-sections, even if their child was low risk, you know, good position, could, you know, conceivably be safely delivered. It was often a hospital policy, and that contributed, that was one of the contributing factors to, as well as many, to the increased C-section rate, hovering around 34% in 2011. And I am very happy to say that it's dropped a couple percentages in the last couple of years. And I think that that is in part due to films like Business of Being Born, which I was, you know, deeply influenced by and grateful that Ricky Lake and Abby Epstein are my executive producers, and also increased awareness about options and choices and informed consent for women, that when they agree to be, let's say, induced at 41 weeks, that they know what risks are associated with that. Because cesarean sections are a life-saving procedure. However, it needs to be used thoughtfully and judiciously.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think almost every mother or parent, I should say mother and father, considering the cesarean section, know that it is a major surgery. But I don't know that, you know, the average person who's not a parent or, you know, at that stage yet understands just like how major a surgery that is.
Well, and I think that part of the issue that has occurred in the past 10 years, and I will say that, you know, one of the prevalent issues in the last 10 to 15 years is the increased amount of intervention that women have when they come to the hospital. That if they come to the hospital and they're not in active labor, there is this silent kind of clock in the background that's ticking away. And that if you're not making enough progress, you know, you may start your first intervention with Pitocin, or your water may be broken, or more things can happen. And every time, statistically, every time there's an intervention during the labor and delivery process, that increases your chance of a cesarean section. So, you know, I think that making choices as you go into the labor and delivery process can help you be more informed and allow you to perhaps avoid some unnecessary interventions when it comes up. And I think that getting to the idea of the midwifery model can be adopted by nurses, labor and delivery nurses. The midwifery model can be adopted by obstetricians. Really what it's about is supporting women's natural processes. in terms of avoiding interventions, medical interventions, unless it's absolutely necessary, encouraging women to labor at home until they're in active labor, encouraging women to be active prior to going into labor when they're pregnant, to be active, to make nutritional sound choices, and so that when they go into labor, they are in their optimal health, that they are prepared, and that they don't go into labor fearful, that they go into labor empowered and excited and centered, and so that they can have the best possible outcome of giving birth to a healthy child. So one of the opportunities that I had when I was making the documentary is that I had the opportunity to feature four very different midwifery practices, but at the heart, they were women focused in terms of really promoting well woman care as part of the process in preparing women for their pregnancy and for their labor and delivery.
Well, it's a very balanced film. It's not anti-medical establishment. There is a pushing back because, don't get me wrong, because there is decades now, at least two, maybe three decades, of information that has been being given to young families about just how risk needs to be avoided and how much risk, which kind of is a very kind of, not sinister, but it's a subtle way of suggesting how much that there's, you know, so many pitfalls in this process. But what's nice about your documentary is you're saying, well, let's rethink this. You know, actually, given all these tools that you just described just a moment ago, maybe not so much. Maybe if you're prepared, and a lot of it is psychological, and knowing that you can do this, and empowering the parents, that there's other ways of thinking about this whole process. So I appreciate that part of your documentary.
Adam, thank you. I mean, that it was a really important part of making the documentary. Much of my film work for the past 20 years, I wouldn't say all of it, but much of it really works within this in-between space where I am telling the stories that are often overlooked because they're, you know, not necessarily provocative or sensational. And at the same time, that doesn't make them less important. And in some cases, it makes them even more important because for a woman who, you know, wants to have the best possible outcome for her birth, you know, the best possible pregnancy, you know, for herself and her family and her baby, you know, she wants to know what all her options are. And she may not necessarily be comfortable with a home birth, or she may not have access to midwives that can deliver at, you know, or catch her baby at home. And so what are her options within mainstream obstetrics? And her options within mainstream obstetrics is to work within a midwifery model of care. And that can be with midwives, but it can also be without midwives. I mean, there's plenty of women who read Ina Mae Gaskin's books. They, you know, seek out hypnobirthing. They ingest everything from the, you know, amazing birth educator Penny Simpkin. And so when they go to their obstetrician, they're able to ask the right questions or ask the important questions, such as, you know, what is your cesarean section rate in your practice? Do you do and support delayed cord clamping? Do you allow skin to skin as soon as the baby is delivered? You know, there's critical questions that you can ask your care provider, whether they're a midwife or not, that will help support a positive birth experience. And I think that's what this documentary is really about, showing diversity of practices and how in these diversity of midwifery practices, midwives support women to have healthy and positive birth experiences.
It's terrific in that regard, and I just appreciate how it could have had one of these, you know, more escalated tones to the film, which you see more frequently than not, where, you know, there's this very militant sort of approach to pushing really hard against the medical community, the establishment, in that way, in terms of how, you know, doctors deliver babies in hospitals, and cesareans are used frequently, more frequently than not, on an increasing rate. But this is great because exactly what you're saying, it's about
presenting all the options. Sure, and what the documentary shows is midwives working collaboratively with doctors.
Sure.
And what I'm really proud of is that we show a diversity of births. There are seven births in the documentary, and so we feature a cesarean section that is because a mama has a baby whose placenta previa, the placenta is actually over the cervix, which is a dangerous condition, and a cesarean delivery is the safest option for her. So I show an example of how, you know, of the benefits in some cases of a cesarean section. I show a water birth, a vaginal delivery of a breech baby, natural childbirth. And I also show an example of a birth that is touch and go for a little bit. That's not, you know, that's not the perfect birth, but that through the patience of the midwife and, you know, really following very closely the baby's progress, rather than rolling her and the mama immediately into the OR, they take a moment, they take a step back, they monitor the baby, and then the mama has this beautiful vaginal delivery. So I show a diversity of birth, and I think that through showing the diversity of birth, showing the cesarean section, showing a water birth, showing a vaginal birth, you know, a natural childbirth, showing a birth that's a little bit touch and go, when audiences watch it, they become less fearful about the topic of birth.
I think that's
also a really important takeaway from the film.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Tell me a little bit from the filmmaking standpoint, you, from the notes and from the mythology around this documentary, Bridget, you gave what was it like, as soon as you gave birth to your older child, your son, you know, you just decided, I've got him. Was it then that you decided, or was it with the daughter? No, it had to be the daughter because she's only 3 and a half. So let me.
The moment
you gave birth, vaginal birth, you said, I'm going to have to make a documentary about midwives.
Yes, I blurted that out. So, you know, prior to the birth of my daughter, you know, I'm a filmmaker. I was looking for like what was going to be the next film that I was going to make. And I was surprised at how there was not a documentary out there that followed hospital midwives, and that so many people associated midwives with home birth when 95% of midwives work within the hospital system. And so I thought, there needs to be a story to be told, but I wasn't sure that I was necessarily the one to tell it. And I was still, you know, very much hoping for a successful VBAC, and that's where my focus was. But, you know, the more and more I told people about this amazing care that I was getting with my midwifery team, the more and more people would say, like, okay, good luck with your home birth. And I'd think, gosh, they just missed the point. They just missed what I was just describing. In that I go to, you know, I'm going to a hospital that I go to a practice, at a hospital, you know, every month or every couple of weeks for my prenatal checkups. And so
can I interrupt for a second? I just wanted to insert, because I do want to hear the rest of the filmmaking, you know, origin story. But the thing is just, that's a great example of how a successful, I don't know if it's, you know, drug companies, I don't know if it's insurance companies, I'm not pointing the finger, but it just shows kind of how successful that version was, because, you know, most people probably think, you know, if you're not giving birth in this traditional way with the, you know, opposite OBGYN or whatever in the hospital, that you're doing it like in a tent at home or some crazy thing. I don't know.
I think that there's a lot of misconceptions around midwifery. I think that there's misconceptions about home births and midwives who catch births at home. I think that there's misconceptions around the role that hospital midwives play in collaboration with doctors, and even what they do, even that they work within hospitals. And I think that all of the mythology around the role of midwives really needs to be unpacked. And I really hope that this documentary can achieve that. You know, what was interesting about my birth experience is that my birth was long. My labor was long, and it was not easy. And Josephine turned out to be 9 pounds, 10 ounces with her little fist up. I always refer to her as the little feminist. My son, who was C-section, was 7 pounds, 15 ounces. So, you know, I had this amazing, long, you know, labor and delivery, and then Josie comes out, and I am so excited and empowered, and I look at my midwife, and I said, I'm doing a documentary about hospital midwives. And the midwife, to her credit, looked up at me without missing a beat and said, that's great, and then continued to, you know, I continued the process because I wasn't even like, I had literally just had Josephine. So at that point, I knew that I was the one to tell the story.
How did you pair up with Ricky Lake then? I know Business of Being Born was a very successful documentary. It came out within the last 5 or 6 years. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I've been great admirers of the work that they did. You know, their film, I think, was still hitting the film festivals when I was pregnant with my son. So I missed the release of it. And had I watched it, and many women who have had unnecessary C-sections around that time can't help but reflect, had we watched that documentary before we had gone into labor, we would have made different choices. And so they've made a huge contribution. I mean, I think it's one of the... I think you can easily say that that Business of Being Born is a documentary that has had one of the biggest impacts in promoting social change in the 21st century. And so to have their support is an incredible honor. And I certainly reached out to them when I was making the documentary. I was grateful to have their social site, My Best Birth, feature early web series that highlighted some of the filming that I was doing at that time. This was about 2 years ago. And then when the film was finished, I was really grateful that, you know, they wanted to support the film and come on board as executive producers.
Well, what's great is that a lot of people will have the opportunity to see this film. Most people have a stake either, like as you said earlier on, they're either going to be parents or, you know, maybe grandparents or their brothers and sisters of people and having about maybe planning or having a baby. And it just opens up the conversation and the world of possibilities of how you start your baby's life. It's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, again, the outside of the education that the film can provide for women who are thinking about having babies or who are pregnant and their partners and family is that this film can help to demystify the process of birth and to help promote a healthy media image around birth in America so that, you know, we don't fear birth so much, because when you turn on the television, oftentimes you'll see women go into labor and their water will break and it'll be just a tsunami across the room. They'll start screaming and, you know, a few minutes later into the episode, they're either screaming their head off and yelling at their partners or they're being wheeled into a cesarean section. And I think that unfortunately contributes to our fearful images of birth. And the more we can have positive images of birth in documentaries and, frankly, on television and in fiction films, the more it can contribute to our healthy and positive consciousness around an incredible moment in a person's life, which is you know, giving birth or being there while your partner gives birth to your child.
The name again, the documentary we're talking about is called Mama Sherpas, and you can go and watch it right now on iTunes, Amazon.
It's going to be on iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, Google Play. So coming to a streaming service near you.
Well, thanks very kindly for spending some time with me and coming on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. It's such an honor, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
I just did another TV BK Live show with these guys today, and then while we were waiting around for to go into the studio, we quickly recorded this relatively short conversation about Five Star, a terrific, terrific indie film. Again, it's at the IFC Center. I'll be there. It's opening Friday night,
the 24th of July here in New York. We'll go open in a week later in L.A. And then in August, I think on the 14th, but don't quote me, it will be available on demand. But in the meantime, if you're in New York, come over to the IFC Center this weekend and check out Five Star. Keith and John and Primo will all be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I myself will be moderating two Q&As on Saturday night at the 6:05, I think. And there's another one, the screening after that, which is probably around 8 o'clock or so. So we're going to have two screenings on Saturday night. I'll be doing Q&As with the guys both times. So please come out and join us, and then come out with us and have some fun afterwards. So here's my conversation with Keith, Primo, and John regarding their film, Five Star.
March 24th. 2008, a little boy was born. My son. You know where I was? I was locked up. And I teared like a baby because I missed the most important part of my son's life.
You said you want to man up. Ain't no room for boys over here.
I'm listening.
Look at me. Ain't no sympathy in this. If you're in this, you win this.
Casey, Benz, they all work for me because of respect. You know why? Because they fear me. Because if one slip up, there are consequences.
Somebody got shot, somebody got stabbed. They found somebody dead in the building.
I want you to tell me who my father was. What? Who was he?
Don't try to fight for something so that you might get answers you don't want to know.
What if I do want to know?
So we're here with Keith Miller, filmmaker, director of Five Star. And I was listening today on the way in to our first interview, episode number 41, if I'm not mistaken. That's how far back we
go. So I'm an early adopter, like a pioneer.
Exactly. You're grandfathered in. That means you don't have to. You won't get charged for this.
But how about Primo?
On the other hand.
Oh, man. Adam, we got history, bro.
It's true. All right. So we're here again with Keith Miller, director of Five Star, one of the elite actors. Primo's here, and one of the producers, Dal Freimark, joining me. We're expecting John Diaz. We're here with publicist Katrina Wan. Lovely to meet you finally. Unless we've met before, it's very possible.
Are you hitting on Katrina, bro?
No, no.
Okay.
That's not professional.
All right.
No. I'll let you know. Oh, you'll know. I try to control myself on the show, you know, just barely. And we're waiting for John, who is one of the co-stars of the film. Keith, as I said, this is your second appearance. So you came on with Welcome to Pine Hill.
And then again with BFC, with Eva and Alex.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
Good memory. Yes. Oh, wow.
These are peak
That's
moments
right.
of my life. They're just regular happenstance things to you. I understand that.
That's true. No. No, that's great. I love that. That's right. This is your third time on. Your three-peat. Primo's first time on Filmwire's Radio.
Won't be the last.
Thank you. That would be great. Have you ever done a podcast?
No.
Oh, so great. So we're popping your
first
cherry,
time.
So to
yep.
speak. And Daryl was on Ish once before.
Yeah,
do you remember that?
Yeah, I snuck in the room.
That was with actress Kelly
I don't remember.
Trieste Dunn.
Oh, yeah, that's who it was.
You remember her?
TV show.
Yeah. Well, she was in a movie. She was
right.
in a movie, too, called Loves Her Gun, I think. But today we're about to go on the TV show, so we only have a little bit of time. I wanted to make sure we squeeze this in because Friday, July 24th, in New York City, you're going to premiere Five Star, finally.
Theater.
It's been a long ride because I saw it at Tribeca last year. What has been going on since last April 2014?
Man, we've been to a lot of film festivals, you know, winning
awards. How many have you gone to?
I believe.
Roughly. Like 20?
Yeah.
40?
About 40.
Wow.
Yeah. Arkansas, Cairo, you know.
Cairo?
Yeah, we were at
Arkansas, Cairo.
Little, yeah, well, I would say that we were internationally. We went to Venice, Thessaloniki, Wroclaw, Poland,
wow.
Cairo.
Did you go to all those? Okay.
Stockholm. Yeah.
Did you go to Europe though?
No.
No, you didn't. Oh, you didn't go to Europe. You got a big family, right? You got.
It's hard for you. I got responsibilities
I
do have to attend to at home, so
yeah.
I wasn't able to go to all of them.
Okay.
And we were at Seattle and New Orleans. We played a lot of different festivals.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, John and Primo won awards at a bunch of the festivals.
For, like, acting?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which one would you get?
Honorable mention award from, where was that? Victoria.
And also from Tallgrass.
Yeah, from Tallgrass. I mean, it's
for, what was that one? Tallgrass. Yeah. Oh, Tallgrass. Oh, that's a good festival I hear.
John went. We didn't go.
Okay. That's right. The advantage of a team is that you can go to some of the festivals, and mm-hmm. then you can go to some if you can't make. Because sometimes they're overlap, or just it's crazy trying to coordinate and schedule everything in such a short amount of time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The film is about, well, Primo, you play a gang leader, right?
Yes.
And a family man.
Yes.
Okay. And by the way, I mean, the seamlessness of those two things, which we typically think of as not necessarily being the same personality. What's nice about the film is not only do you pull that off and so credibly, but also that actually is generally the case. It's like, you know, we see it sometimes. I guess we saw it a little bit, let's say, in on The Sopranos, the same kind of thing, where one guy can be pretty tough on one hand, but also be extremely affectionate with his family and all that.
I mean, pretty much that's the reality of it.
Yeah.
You have the street life, you know, the life you have to portray as that boss figure.
Uh-huh.
But then you also have that family life, you know, when you're behind the closed doors, home with your family, kids, you know, and you're loving. You might want to be strong and stern, but the family is what knows you the best.
Mm-hmm. So, you know. What's the level of the collaboration between you and Keith in terms of the script?
I would say 100%. You know, we've spoken about, you know, things that have happened in my life, and, you know, he's told me some things that have happened in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you can say we put both of them together with some added fiction,
mm-hmm.
and he made a great film. We made a great film.
Yeah, yeah. So was this something that, Keith, was this something that was percolating when you were still making and maybe, you know, exhibiting Pine Hill?
I knew that after Welcome to Pine Hill, I wanted to make a movie that explored ideas of what it meant to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I didn't know exactly what kind, and, you know, I think that abstract ideas are never a good basis for a film until, like, people are actually doing something. And then Shannon from Pine Hill introduced me to Primo.
Okay, that's
because they were bouncers in the same
place. Okay. I probably knew that at one point.
And, you know, we talked, and I shot a conversation that we had and edited it down, but we kind of, you know, clicked.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of positive energy, and the idea of collaborating on the story was, you know, came together.
Yeah.
And then, so a lot of the, you know, to go back to the question you just asked, Primo, about the story, like, a lot of the specifics are very much true, but the overarching story,
right,
that was the kind of, that's the big part of the made up part.
You know, we just talked about that kind of, what do you call it? Not a juxtaposition, but the contradiction, or the, you know, the ends of extreme, like, one could be very violent and extremely affectionate. I like that. I also like that there's this very documentary, very real sense of this, of the characters, the background. It's shot on the streets of East Brooklyn.
In Fort Greene.
In Fort Greene? It was all shot in Fort Greene?
Almost.
Okay.
All of it, yeah.
Let me rephrase. Entirely shot on the streets of Brooklyn, or more or less shot on the streets of Brooklyn. And what I like, though, is that the storyline, the arc of the story, kind of has an old-fashioned, you know, arc to it. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of the story, Primo, the surrogate, in a way, father figure for this young kid who's dealing with, as Keith mentioned, growing.
I wouldn't call it old-fashioned. I mean, if you look at everyday life today in certain environments, certain neighborhoods, that's pretty much how it is, you know.
Let me explain. I meant to, like, the arc of the story, the fact, like, that it has this timeless, like,
archetypal
storyline about, you know, the guy, the father figure. It turns out he's, I'm not going to give away anything.
Yeah,
but we find something out about your real relationship with John, the character John's father,
mm-hmm.
and what happened to him, and your character, and that background story, and how things come to a head by the end of the film. That is very reminiscent of a lot of Hollywood, like, gangster films.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Kind of thing, which is lovely.
I was hoping to make a structure that felt solid like that, but after we finished shooting, when I was near the end of editing, two friends were, unrelated friends, were in productions of Hamlet. And I just happened to see two versions of Hamlet all of a sudden.
Right.
And, you know, Hamlet is about the father that's gone, the son trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of parallels. And I was
there
like,
is.
Oh, I wish I had seen this before, because I could have just apply that. But, you know, I think the thing is when you have, it's really like two coming of age stories that kind of crash against each other, set in a real life, in a very real world with love interests and maternal concerns and paternal concerns. And so there's something archetypal about that.
Yeah. Prima, did you watch, first of all, were you a movie guy?
Yeah.
Like, were you already into big time?
I'm very big on movies. I actually own over 2,000 DVDs. So, yeah.
Did you just move into a DVD rental store at one point around?
It's a habit of mine.
What?
It's a hobby. Some guys collect baseball cards. I collect movies.
All right. I mean, you don't have enough time to watch that many. I know it's collecting is okay. No, I understand. And also, collecting is in of itself the part of the pleasure, kind of curating your own collection of movies. Yep. So, not to put you on the spot, but do you have like a favorite genre or a particular category of films that you particularly connect with?
I like mafia films.
Yeah,
old mobster film. Old.
Like how old?
We can go back to The Godfather. You know, I like all genres. As long as it's interesting, the acting's great. Like, my favorite movie of all time will always be Dog Day Afternoon.
That's a good one. You know, I would put that up there with my favorites.
Yeah, that's my favorite movie of all time.
Does he know about the document of the dog? Did you see that yet?
No.
Those guys were on my show. The guys that directed. It's about the real-life guy that character Al Pacino plays was based on. He was a real guy.
Okay.
That story really happened.
Yeah,
the bank
heist. I know that.
So that guy is the subject of a documentary that came out like 2 years ago. Okay. Called The Dog, because that was his nickname once he went to prison.
Nice.
They called him The Dog because of Dog Day Afternoon. Actually came out when he was in prison. And so it was
That's crazy.
Yeah. He didn't stay in jail too long, that guy, either. It was pretty incredible. Like, the guy robbed that bank in Brooklyn. He got out pretty quick, considering, you know. That's a great film. But you can watch gangster films and mafia films going all the way back to the beginning of cinema. I mean, almost. It's really back to the 30s, right, with, you know, James Cagney and... Scarface and what is Paul? What are those guys? White Heat. Paul, a lot of early Edward G. Robinson and a few of these other guys.
Even like today, Robert De Niro is an incredible actor, man.
Mm-hmm.
Heat will be like the all-time favorite Robert De Niro film ever.
Oh, Heat.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good one. Yeah. Always. Well, there's and your other guys in there.
It's one of many.
What?
It's
What'd you say, Keith?
Many.
No.
Talking. What'd you say?
It's mine.
Yeah, Taxi Driver's correct. I mean, it's not even it's not a comparison.
Oh, you're comparing Taxi Driver and Heat. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, but different people.
The
have,
style.
Yeah.
And what the movie was going for.
Yeah.
Is completely different.
Yeah.
Than Taxi Driver. So my once again, all time favorite Robert De Niro film is John Deere's, ladies and gentlemen.
John
one
Deere's.
Night only, J.D. Banks.
That's okay. Oh, thank God, somebody wearing.
Another pair of glasses.
Don't. Hey, John. Good to see you. Good. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. We did a Q&A at Tribeca last year. And
you had one of the best Q&As.
Oh, well.
That's
high praise. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, I had a good time, too. Because usually they'll just assign you arbitrarily. And I said, well, you know, obviously I knew you were in, so I asked for that. So I'm glad it worked out. John, you play John.
Yes.
So, which is, I already gave kind of a little bit of the back description of the film, which is, you know, you're become sort of a mentee, but is that the right word? You sort of,
I'm a mentee.
To Primo, he takes you under his wing, right? You've lost your dad. You're kind of, you're coming of age in the film. You're kind of a sensitive kid, but at the same time, you grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood, so you got to usually prove your own, right? Plus,
I feel like that's just like, with this specific role, I feel like it was literally perfect for me, just because I do live in bad neighborhoods, and it's a situation where it's like I'm still a very sensitive kid. Anybody that meets me, they're like, oh, John's very happy, he's very smiley, he's not really mean. So it's like I've kept that demeanor with me even in real life. So it's like it was very easy to portray on the screen.
Where does that come from?
Lower,
the sensitive side.
Lower East Side Manhattan.
And where does your sensitive side come from?
Growing up with living with my mom and sister.
Mm-hmm.
No males in the house.
Oh, I see.
Just two women. And then the only other person that I really looked at as a figure to me was my aunt. So it's like those are the three women in my life. Those are the only thing that really matters. So it's a situation where it's like, they taught me both ways very easily, and they taught me how to treat women and how to not disrespect in the street, and how to hold my my character and posture right. So
that's neat.
And I think that's why the scenes with his mom are so great.
And your girlfriend.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. How have you changed since the film?
I got dreadlocks.
Yeah, I can see that. They look good on you, too. I noticed. First thing I noticed.
No. Right
after your sneakers.
Just really learning not how to judge a book by its cover. When I first met Primo, I was very, can't lie, intimidated by him. Mm-hmm. He's an intimidating guy, especially when you first meet him off the back. You don't know what direction to go with him. But at the same time, like, mm-hmm. once I got to meet him and mm-hmm. meet his kids and meet his wife and, like, really meet the family and mm-hmm. and live that life, that sort of life inside that people don't really see of him, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, like, you, like, I don't know what Keith's doing.
I bet Keith rather that he couldn't eat his shoe. So he's starting with the laces. It's sort of a very Charlie Chaplin meets Werner Herzog thing to do.
Did you break it?
No,
just
as
not.
Keep talking. You got a lot to say.
But yeah, so it's just don't judge a book by its cover, and yeah.
That's good.
JB Banks, ladies and gentlemen, One Night Only. CD will be out this Friday, July 24th. Hi to you, too. Go and support that.
Yo, that was a major plug-in.
You're a musician, too?
Yeah, I rap. I sing. Uh-huh. I do all that stuff. I started with musical theater. Like, my first acting gig was Grease. And I
played Danny. Zuko?
Yeah, the musical. Mm-hmm. So it was.
Can you do a verse from
Summer Nights?
Oh, there you go.
Your blast.
That's yeah.
Summer
I'm not
nights
doing.
Happened so fast.
Primo, can you do the Sandy?
Crazy about me.
Oh, there. That was Darryl.
I met a girl, cool as can be.
Summer days drifting away. Okay.
Oh, the summer light. Oh, wella, wella, wella. Oh.
Okay, after that, I don't know what's... Well, it's going to be exciting because now you're back finally in New York City, where it all started, and you're going to have your first, your premiere on Friday, this Friday. This podcast segment will be up in time.
And it's already sold out.
Somebody, wow, I was going to say...
Somebody just called me to try to buy tickets
for
Friday.
But, oh, for Friday evening?
Friday at 8:30, it's sold
out. They couldn't
out
do it?
Yeah.
6:05 Friday.
They can still buy tickets for 6:05 Friday.
No, just go on to the IFC.
We're all day Saturday.
All day Saturday.
Four screenings on Saturday. Four Darryl screenings on Sunday.
That's Darryl. And how many are you guys going to be at for Q&As? Like, what's the schedule?
I think we have 3 Q&As.
Okay.
But, uh-huh, you know, me and Primo, you know, you never know. You never know, man. You might just come to a screening and see us there.
That's right. You may actually get, during the film, start
during
taking
the film,
questions.
I might just stand up.
And start taking questions.
Say, that's me.
Yeah. And you'll identify John by his Dayglo kicks or whatever. And Keith, you're going to be there Friday, Saturday. Although,
yeah, I'll be there.
I can't hear you. Sorry.
I will be there for the Q&A on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at
okay
the 8:30 screening. I think that's the plan.
Yeah, that's it?
Saturday Q&A 6:05.
Saturday Q&A 6:05.
Okay. Yeah.
And I will be introducing the Friday 6:05.
Okay.
Okay. No right Q&A. They're not allowed to ask questions. Only in front of the theater.
Gotcha. Okay.
John and Primo will be hanging around the front of the theater all weekend.
Well, that's
from
important.
The 12 o'clock screening on.
Okay. We're almost ready. I want to say a couple of things. One is, because this podcast is listened to all over, not just like this TV show is we're going to go into is Brooklyn-based, so we don't really need to talk about L.A. We don't need to go talk about On Demand. But for the purposes of the podcast, we can, because we have listeners in L.A. and in between on flyover country, where all the festivals are. So let's talk about that real mm-hmm. before we stop, because we're getting close to so Keith, this is going to be opening in LA on the, what is that, the first or what 31st. Day is 31st? Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. that's right, this month is 31
yeah,
days
on 31st,
July 31st at the
Arena Hollywood.
Thank you.
And then on August 4th it'll be on VOD
on demand,
available everywhere in the world.
So on cable?
No. Anywhere in the world, as long as it's the United States or possibly Canada.
And you have Wi-Fi. Producer Darryl Freimark.
Canada will be just iTunes at this time, and it'll be on VOD everywhere in the United States, all major cable networks.
Okay, so all the cable networks plus iTunes plus...
But if you do have that way to hack into Netflix or things that people use in Europe and, you know, other places, then you can really see it anywhere.
You'll be able to see it all
we
around the world
patient,
in a matter
though
of time anyway, so just be patient. And we'll have you guys back on where we can talk even longer. Okay, so final final words? Want it to be the final word?
Come check out the film, five-star the movie. It's a very beautiful movie. Great director, great star, John Diaz. We're also going to be at the IFC Theater signing posters, taking photographs and everything, trying to interact with the crowd, and we'd love to see everyone there. Thanks to Exhilarator for helping us out and playing a major role in this film. Thank you, Daryl, Louisa, Keith, Russell, John Diaz, beautiful person, my beautiful wife, our families.
All right. That's way too much.
So
I'm kidding around.
So what?
It's on Facebook.
The date everyone should be at the theater is July 24th, this Friday.
Let's
we will be there for the 8:30 p.m. show.
Okay.
How long will the movie be playing? The movie will be playing all weekend.
All week.
Fantastic.
I just want to say that you can go to Facebook and find 5-Star the movie on Facebook. You can find 5-Star, it's the website, Keith. 5starmovie.com. And also, what was I going to say?
If you'd like to follow me and John on Instagram... My Instagram
that.
Is Big Homie Primo, all one word, John.
JD Banks _.
And also, what's the name of your CD?
Mixtape coming out
mixtape.
July 24th, same day as the movie comes out. It's called Hi to You Too.
Where can they get it?
You can download it at HiToYouTwo.com. It's that simple. HIGH2U.com.
Fantastic.
JD Banks, ladies and gentlemen, one night only.
All right, well, now
you can also hear John in the closing credits song on the film singing, you know, the namesake of the movie, 5-Star.
Terrific. Okay, guys, let's do some TV now.
I know how things work. When my pops died, it's like no one had to pay for it.
Everybody answers to me. It don't go down unless it goes through me. Your pops took me in at the same age you is. Respected by everybody. Bloods, Crips, Kings, everybody.
You want for me to be blood, man?
I'm a 5-Star. They don't question me. Say the word right now. Put it in the books.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you for everything. Thank you for all your great support of the show. Remember, go to iTunes. It takes a moment. You go to the iTunes store, and then you search for Film Wax. That's how it's done. And when it comes up, click on the Film Wax icon to bring up the Film Wax page. Okay, so there's two steps there. And then you can subscribe. It's right, big button right there. And then click on a star rating. Leave a comment. You'll see that option. Do all that stuff for me. It only takes a couple of moments. The show is free. I'm bringing you top indie film filmmakers and actors, and I need your help with that. It only takes a couple of minutes. Feel good about doing something easy and free, and that only takes a minute out of your time. Okay? So please do that. And if you really want to go out of your way, share the show with your friends and your family and anybody you know that loves films. Please, you know they're going to like this show, right? Because we get into it. We talk, it's loose, it's fast, it's loose. But we also talk about the nitty-gritty. We get into it. We get into the specifics, how you get your film out there. You know, it's all there. But also just conversation, good conversation. What more could you want? All right? So do me that kindness and help a brother out, okay? And, of course, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. Do check us out. Get involved. You can go to filmwaxradio.com. You can get in touch with me, whatever you want to do. Thank you for listening. Okay, we'll be back next week with James Ponsoldt regarding his film, The End of the Tour. Patrick Wang, filmmaker with a movie called The Grief of Others, which I saw at South by Southwest. We'll have Patrick on. All right, guys. And many more shows with many more film people and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Thanks for listening to the show. All right, this is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, thank you so much. Take care.